Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we love to talk about teaching multilingual learners. I'm your host, Colette Ferrone Goodwin, and I'm a resource specialist on the EML team with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network at OCM BOCES in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to another episode of Our Burning Questions. Today's Our Burning Questions are, how does having a disability affect English language learners or multilingual learners? And what additional supports can be provided to ensure their success? And here to respond to these questions is my very special guest, Ariana Rosario. Welcome, Ariana.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're excited to have you. So, Ariana, could you just maybe take a little bit of time and just introduce yourself, tell us your role, your special areas of interest, and what drew you to working with ELLS?
Yeah, so my name is Ariana Rosario, and I am an English as a new language teacher for North Syracuse Central School District. And my areas of special interest are working with English learners and students with disabilities. And I've always had a passion for working with English language learners. I taught in the Dominican Republic before I went to college, and that was just something that really drew me to English language learners. And I was able to major in bilingual education. And I found that, and I was in the gen ed classroom, but I really just found myself, I just loved being able to advocate for English language learners. So that's kind of how I ended up in this role.
So that's really cool, though, that you have that gen ed perspective as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's made me a better teacher in this role because I understand, you know, what the big systemic issues are that, you know, English language learners sometimes struggle with. And I understand how getting caught up in with the students with disabilities, it can be an issue. And sometimes it's hard getting student services, and sometimes we're over-identifying services too. So it's been nice to be able to kind of figure out those tricky waters.
Nice. And so are you also certified in bilingual ed as well?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. So for Spanish or?
Yes.
Okay. Very cool. You are a highly coveted teacher. And you are like, you're triply certified.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Gen ed, bilingual ed, special ed, and then, you know, yeah.
Oh, special ed too?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's awesome. Okay. So you said that your area of interest is special ed and students with disabilities. So talking about ELLS with disabilities, how does having a disability affect new language learning?
I think it becomes, you know, that it's just another barrier to English language learning, you know, I think, and sometimes it can get confusing because a lot of the behaviors that you'll see is it because of their language or is it because of their disability, you know? And I think that too, thinking about it from like a bigger perspective, you have to think about the cultural aspect of where our students right. come from and how kids with disabilities are treated in other countries or what notions that their families might have about the disability and kind of figuring out how that works in the American system, which can be an extra challenge, right. you know?
Yeah. So, could you tell us maybe specifically what challenges do ELLS with disabilities face?
Yeah, I think sometimes, you know, there's a little bit of discrimination because people don't know what to do with them, that they kind of end up sitting in the back corner and they're like, they can only do this. You know, I think sometimes that they're not given the same curriculum opportunities as some of maybe the other students are because people don't know what to do with them unless the ENL teacher is able to be in the room with them for that entire time.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely a challenge. How is having a disability as an L or ML different from having one as a native speaker of English?
I think it's different because you're also working on developing those language skills. And just because you have a disability doesn't mean that you're not able to develop those English skills. It just means it's going to take some extra time and maybe some creative avenues than the traditional ones that we technique that we generally give our students. And I think also when we're thinking about the IEP, it's really thinking about how can we make a culturally linguistically appropriate IEP, which I don't think, you know, we just don't have, everybody doesn't have the education or background knowledge on how to do that, because right. this is, you know, it's not a new thing, but it is a new thing that we're seeing more of, you know, and making sure that we want to make sure that we're providing all of those language supports and reminding everyone that everyone is a language teacher, not just the ENL teacher, and that we need to be making sure we're including those supports in all the time, not just in the small 40-minute ELA block.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking too, along those lines, that a lot of the assessments that might be administered for students in English are not offered in other languages. And that's really important, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they're not given, you know, those opportunities. And so what might look like a major disability might not be just because we're not able to administer it in their home language or have someone to score. If we're able to administer right. it in their home language, just because I can administer it to you doesn't mean I can score it because I don't have your home language. So that becomes like an added factor. I know, like with our state test, you know, now New York State provides them in different languages, which is great. But then when you have someone, you know, when you have a student who's taking it and you're trying to make sure they're clicking on the right buttons, it can be kind of intimidating because you don't, you know, you feel what they feel because you don't read their language. So, right. you know, it can be a little intimidating on both ends.
Sure. Absolutely. It makes it very hard to support them.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, for sure. So what are some things that we should look for when trying to distinguish between a language difference versus a language disability? I know that can be confusing sometimes, and that's what results in the over-identifying, right?
Absolutely. And this is something that I'm very passionate about, making sure that our teachers have education about those differences. I think the different behaviors can sometimes mask what that looks like, but I think making sure everyone knows what does an emerging English language learner look like? What are those expectations? You know, what are those perceived behaviors that, you know, the expectation isn't that everybody is on grade level the entire time, you know, making sure that you're like gradually giving the students what they need. I think another thing to look out for is I always ask my students, like, what is your dominant, you know, what is that dominant language? What language do they dream in? Really getting to know the family. Do they have difficult with their L1? Did they notice patterns like in the beginning? Did they have trouble speaking in their L1? And now those same mistakes are transferring to that L2. Is there a speech issue in the L1? And is that transferring over to English now? Or is it just, you know, for example, I have an Arabic speaker who was put through our RTI process and they wanted to give him special education services because he wasn't making growth with his digraphs and he was continuing to make the same mistakes over those 10 weeks. But if you look at, you know, the Arabic language, you know that, you know, there's no CH sound. So it's really, you know, it's really difficult to make that sound that doesn't exist in your language. So it just takes that extra time. So really getting to know the student's background and getting to know the student's language and seeing what linguistic differences are there. And if it is a nuance in their language that doesn't exist in English, then maybe we should be targeting that and paying more attention to that.
Right. And so even if they work with a speech teacher, they do have that linguistic background, but if they don't have the knowledge of the home language, then it could be
an issue, right? Because they're like, yes, they're making these, you know, they're having these issues with the speech, or they're having, you know, I'm noticing there's issues with the syntax. But if it's because of the first language, you know, really getting to know that home language. And I know Portland State University put out the monolingual bilingual lab. And I love that resource so much because it gives, you know, it's not perfect, but it gives a variety of languages. It gives a history of the culture and what happened. So that way you have a better background, and it gives a, you know, a lowdown of the language too, of like what vowels are different, what is the syntax like? What is the grammar like? What are common mistakes that, you know, people who are first learning English are going to make? So it's been a nice resource to be able to give all of our teachers who are working with all of our L's, so that way they can kind of have a background of the culture, a background of the language, without having to, you know, sit through a long PD about each culture and each language that we have. Because as much as we would all like to do that, there's not enough time in the day mm-hmm. to be able to do all those things. So I know that's been very helpful. And we've been able to do a lot of targeted interventions interventions for those students with the services that they need with that. So that's been really great. I will definitely share it with you. It's been one of my favorite resources that I've been able to share with all my teachers that work with RLs.
Okay, perfect. When we think about giving support to L's with disabilities, thinking about the additional support that can be provided that to ensure that they're successful, what are some things that we could do?
I think the notion that I know that was like a big notion in our district, and I'm sure it is in others, it's hard to find time to give all of the resources. However, our students are entitled to their ENL time as well as their specially designed instruction time. And it's not I know I've heard before special education trumps ENL, and that's simply, that is not true, that we need to be making sure that they are receiving both. And like I said before, kind of making sure that as a whole team, we're sitting down to create a linguistically and culturally appropriate IEP. I know that I fought my way onto what we call our CERT, which is where we get, it's a resource of a group of people that we get together and talk about a student before we send them off to the CSE. And I made sure I fought my way onto there, and I make sure that I'm included in every single one of our CSEs to make sure that we are including language appropriate goals on their IEP, because sometimes when you make a general goal, it's not always going to be appropriate for where our English language learners are in their language development. So kind of making sure everything is adding up.
Yeah. And when you think about students with disabilities, there's that IEP that's put in place, that legal document. And unfortunately, there isn't one for English language.
Correct.
So I can see where that misconception of the special ed services being
more important, but they're equally important, and they're both things that students need. And we do, as an L teacher, I am also legally bound to give students certain, we do have mandates that we need to follow, but I think because there is no ENL IEP, that people kind of forget about that sometimes. Or another misnomer that I've hear a lot is that my ENL is a tier 3 service. And then, and so we've had to talk about that a lot too, that is not a tier 3 service, that is a tier 1 service for my English language learners, that they need to have both. So that I think kind of breaking down what ENL actually is, because I think especially in, I know I've worked in a school before where there weren't a lot of English language learners, so nobody really knew what to do because it was a newer problem that they were having. Nobody had the background or research in what to do. So making sure, providing that education so that way, ignorance isn't just running around the school.
Yeah. Understood. So I think you may have touched on this earlier on in the conversation, but what was your reason for focusing on this area?
Yeah. Well, I always, I've always had a passion for working with students with disabilities as well as English language learners, but more recently I was able to do an action research project through AFT where I was literally looking at our district as a whole. And I was noticing that, our district was, my big question was, how can we prevent the over and under identifying of students with disabilities that were L's? And I noticed that our students that were in our English language learner program, a lot of them were also receiving special education services. And I was thinking about, why is this happening? And I realized that, we weren't necessarily following the RTI process for L's. We were giving them, we were putting them in an intervention for 10 weeks. We were saying, oh, that doesn't work. And moving, we were pushing kids through the system without really thinking about their whole needs and not really getting to know the families and their language background and kind of not including any of it. So we, being able to really look at, what New York State suggests you should do with the RTI process, it's been out since 2010. When I brought it back to my district leadership, and it was very new for everybody, which, now we know better, we do better. And so making sure that in order to prevent we were having a problem with over-identifying. I know some districts, it's the opposite way where they under-identify. So making sure, I know some districts are over-identifying and some districts are under-identifying, we were definitely over-identifying our students. So making sure, what are our procedures to make sure we are not over-identifying, making sure that we were following an intervention program, making sure we were really looking at the language differences between what their home language was and what English is, making sure that we were seeing where they were on what level they were at, what behaviors they were exhibiting, really making sure that the gen education teacher knew what these were, if they were receiving a tier two or tier three services, making sure that they, we check in every 2 weeks with our progress monitoring to see how our students are doing. And that's been a really great time. And all of our RTI teachers have been so excited, and they really wanted to learn about this because they felt bad because they didn't know what to do and they kind of didn't know where to look. So we've been doing an awesome job about teaming up together to make sure we're giving proper interventions and not just sending them to the CSE table because they aren't making the, you know, the right progress. So that's been a real blessing, and we've noticed a big difference in how we bring our students to the table.
How challenging was it to kind of introduce those ideas and those protocols?
I was very fortunate at our school because the English language, the English as a new language program at our school is so new that all of our teachers wanted education. They really wanted to soak it up. So I know that's not the case everywhere, but I was very fortunate that, you know, everyone kept coming. They wanted more information. They felt bad because they didn't know what to do in these situations. So it was really nice that we were able to kind of talk together, to kind of work together, to figure out what we can do.
Okay. So you kind of gave the reasoning for doing this work and how you advocated for them. So could you maybe just share some words of advice about how to advocate?
Yeah, I think number one thing would be to come with policy. You know, I think is advocating, I think is really, it can be a struggle sometimes because advocating has so much emotion. And I think when we come to the table with emotion, it doesn't always come across the way that we want to. But there, like I said, like when I dug further and saw that this had been in our RTI kind of protocol since 2010. And I was able to bring that to, you know, our director's attention. And they're like, oh yeah, we should be, you know, everybody kind of fell on board with wanting to do best practice. And I think also coming with research, you know, showing what like the bilingual speech lab showing, I know another resource that I really like is Dr. Catherine Collier's book, 7 Steps to Separating Difference from Disability. She has a great book of professional development and resource on what to look for. And, you know, being able to provide education instead of just, you know, me getting upset that we weren't doing what's best for our kids was definitely, I think, a turning point for us. So I could show what the research says, what best practice is, what New York State suggests we should be doing. And then I think it was easier for everyone to be on board.
And I think maybe you touched on this a little bit, but what were the steps that you took to explore this area further for people that might be interested in doing this?
Yeah, I went through AFT, and I did, our school hosted a teacher leader program through AFT, and we had to do an action research project, and this was my action research project that I did on my own. But if anybody would be interested in reading more on it, like I said, Dr. Catherine Collier has a lot of great resources. She is a great first step and kind of really looking at what policies does, you know, and protocols does your own district have, and how are they not already meeting the needs of your students if they're not, and kind of what you looking at what New York State says you should be doing, what research says you should be doing, and kind of combining that together.
What have you learned as a result of this work?
I learned that, you know, there's always room for growth as an educator, and that we always, you know, it's not that, I think sometimes we get frustrated when people aren't doing what we think is the right thing, but I don't think it's always out of malice. I think it's out of because we don't know any better and we don't have the education or weren't exposed to the research right to do it, you know, and I think, you know, thinking about all of our students that we over-identified, it's not that they were purposely trying to discriminate against them. They just didn't know what else to do. Mm-hmm. That this is the only model that they have ever been taught or have used in school. Of this is what you do when a student isn't on grade level, you know? So I think making sure that it's okay to, you know, it's okay to learn from that, and it's okay to ask for more professional development, and it's okay to grow together. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't always have all the answers, and I'm sure, you know, and later it's going to be more research in a few years that we can be doing even better than what we're doing right now. So I know I definitely don't have all the answers, and I know I'm probably not doing everything perfectly, but I think being in a mindset where you're willing to grow and you're willing to look for more education about it is definitely the best way to go.
All right. When you know better, you do better.
Exactly.
That was Maya Angelou. That's and you also touched on the point of that intellectual humility, right? Like we don't know everything, and we can always learn new things.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes as an educator, you get so stuck in your rut of doing the same things over and over again. And especially if you've been doing it a really long time, you know, you're just, it almost becomes mindless, and that's not well it should be, but just create your routines and you don't think about it. So I think being willing, especially if you've been teaching a long time, to kind of step out of your comfort box and try something new and do research into something new is important.
Yeah. And maybe something that might be hindering is the fact that, you know, you're doing this, you've done this for 20 years and it works. So why should I change it? Right.
Right. Right. But I think, you know, especially I know in our district, we have a lot of students who speak a lot of languages that, you know, some people have never heard of, or maybe mm-hmm. they don't know anybody else who speaks that language. And so it's becoming more challenging. It's not just English and Spanish. I have a friend in Rochester who teaches bilingual education, and we talk about all the time how different it is doing bilingual education than it is when you work with a bunch of different languages, because you're not just relying on that translanguaging. You know, I can't rely on my translanguaging right. skills when I am teaching a student whose first language is Arabic or Russian or Ukrainian. Right. You know, our alphabets are very different. So I think, you know, like I said, being able to step out of your comfort zone and try something new is important.
So thinking about your, you know, your instruction and your support of English language learners and multilingual learners, how did all of this new learning impact your instruction support?
I think even in my standalone, I'm thinking more about where are they not in the general education classroom? Where are they not doing well, or where do they need extra support? And I'm thinking more about like their linguistic level of where they are and kind of where I can bridge the gap, I think, a little bit better. Whereas before, I think I was so focused on making sure they had their BICS, because, you know, when they don't have basic vocabulary, you're not going to, you know, it's good, you're going to struggle a little bit harder with all of your academic vocabulary and all that content vocabulary. But I think it's helped me to kind of blend more of it together, and making sure that just because they are not doing well on an assessment, being able to advocate more of just because they're not doing well doesn't mean that they don't have it. You know, on their spelling test, they might have not have spelled the word right, but they got the vowel sound that you wanted to focus on that week. So, you know, they are learning, and being able to show that that is growth. And
so you had mentioned BICS. So yeah. For our listeners that maybe might not be familiar with those acronyms, BICS and
KELP. Oh, yeah, BICS and KELP. So BICS is like your basic everyday conversational English that you would use when you were talking with a friend, or, you know, your basic vocabulary words that you would use like around the house, very casual conversation, whereas your KELP is those more academic, those more rigorous words. So you're thinking of like multi-meaning words, or maybe a multi-syllabic word related to content, more of content-focused vocabulary. And so research shows that, you know, you have to develop your basic vocabulary before you're able to, you know, have those higher vocabulary words. So I think, you know, especially now it becomes harder for a newcomer to get thrown into a lesson about the human body where they're learning all those very specific bones and it's very content specific, but they're not sure how to ask to go to the, but they're not able to say, I need to go to the bathroom or ask, hi, how are you yet? It becomes a big challenge.
Another way to describe that too is social language versus academic language.
Yes. Right? Thank you. Yes.
And it's important also to note that social language is acquired a lot quicker than academic language.
Absolutely. So sometimes too, that was another, you know, I'm glad you brought that up because that was another aspect that we noticed last year was one of my students, you know, she had really high social language. She was able to participate in class. She could talk with her friends. However, her reading comprehension was not as high as you would have think. She was very, you know, she perceived herself to be a lot higher of an English language learner than she actually was. So in a really talking about like, what does that behavior look like? You know, in our Syracuse City School District put out a great chart of what these, all these behaviors are and what challenges they might face. And really using that resource to kind of show my gen ed teachers what they were looking for and to kind of see this is kind of where she is. Maybe she's in between two levels right now because, you know, her oral skills are amazing. You know, she's able to understand what you're doing, but that reading comp is really more of like a level two than that level, than what she's perceiving with her oral language. So I think that can be hard too. But I think then when you think about your own second language acquisition, right, my my writing in my Spanish is actually a lot higher than my speaking in my Spanish, but it's just kind of how you develop it and kind of where you are in that process. You know, I think too that language learning is not necessarily linear in all four language domains, and it kind of like bends and flows with depending on what you're doing and where you are in that process.
Yes, absolutely. So you're referencing a lot of great resources that you use. So I'm going to be sure to share these when we share the episode, but what are some specific examples of supports that you're implemented?
Oh, specific examples would be teaming up with my intervention team so that our students who are, they teach too, because that's another, I think, nuance that I could go on this tangent forever, that just because they're an L does not mean that they can't get tier two or tier three services, that they are entitled to those services as well. But kind of working with those teachers to making sure that we're doing a targeted intervention, we're sharing that data together, we're collecting data, whether that could be where they are with their vowel sounds or sight words, or as far as like their reading fluency or even writing, their writing portfolio. We're making sure we share all that information together so we can talk about what we notice, if we're noticing the same things, if we're noticing different things. And then again, I'll also reference the bilingual speech lab when I'm unfamiliar with a language, and I'll look for information on there to see if I'm noticing that, yes, they're like, maybe it's a short vowel sound issue and they're doing it in their writing, they're doing it in their reading, and maybe in their home language, their short vowel sound is different or flip-flopped with the English one. And I'll say, okay, this is normal. We're going to keep focusing on this, and this is how we're going to target it. So making sure that looking at every relationship as like a partnership and not that your service is better than my service kind of situation.
Yeah. You touched on something really important in terms of mentioning relationship building. It's important for you to build relationships with your colleagues, but it's also equally important to build those relationships with your students.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And their families, you know, and I think a lot of times the families kind of get forgotten about as far as special education services come, or maybe they're afraid because they don't, you know, they don't have, it's not the same in our country as it was in their home country, as far as what does special education look like. And that can be a really terrifying process for some families, and some families are very against it because of a notion. And so kind of making sure that everyone is kind of on the same page, that you really are building those relationships with their students and your families, you understand what their language background is, you know, how well they speak, if they speak at home, if they speak with just their parents or a grandparent or with their siblings, they speak English, how do they do with that? You know, you want to know all those bits and pieces to kind of make up that whole child before you make that decision that you want to push for special education services or not.
For someone that might be interested in learning more about supporting elves with disabilities, what first steps would you suggest?
I would suggest looking into some great professional development that Auburn does offer a lot of great professional development. I also suggest Dr. Catherine Collier's book, 7 Steps to Separating Differences from Disability. That was a really big eye-opener for me, and kind of thinking about all those little parts that I knew but didn't think of to do, where she kind of lays everything out very nicely, and she shows the research as to why this should be this way. So I think it kind of made more sense after I read her book, kind of looking at the full picture.
I know, isn't it interesting how like you have these ideas in your head and you know what the right thing is to do, but until you see somebody like explain it, then yes. somebody packages it together just right to make it make sense. And you're like, oh my goodness.
Yes, it was like a big aha moment for me. I'm like, yes, this is what this should look like, you know. And then she puts it together so nicely with all the, you know, second language acquisition research and mm-hmm. Thinking about that, like, it's not a scary thing. Both can happen, that, you know, just because you have a second language doesn't mean you can't have a disability, and doesn't mean that we should be over-identifying either. So it's just, she kind of lays it out very nicely of what it can look like, and she gives what I like to, she gives case studies about kind of explaining a little bit more. So you have real life examples that I was able to relate to and say, oh yes, I remember when this happened with this student that I had, and kind of really just kind of made the full picture make sense for me.
Well, I've really enjoyed talking with you today. Thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy day. I know you're still at school. And we also forgot to mention that you are also a member of the Mid-State Auburn ENL Council. Oh,
yes, I am. Yes, I should have mentioned that in the beginning. Yeah. I forget. Yes, I am a current member, and we're doing some awesome research, and I'm excited to continue our work as well.
Yes, we're excited to work with you as well. So once again, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guest we had on today's episode or any of the resources we discussed, please visit the Mid-State Auburn webpage. This podcast is produced by Mid-State Auburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Catalyst from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.